Welcome to the Brute Strength Podcast, bringing you worldwide experts from all areas of health and fitness. We cover training, nutrition, coaching, and mindset. Welcome your host, strength and conditioning coach, 2012 and 2013 CrossFit Games champ, Michael Cashew. Mind, body, brute.
Hey, and welcome back. My name is Mike Cashew, and you're listening to the Brute Strength Podcast. This week's guest is Stefan Guyanet. Stefan is the author of the book, The Hungry Brain. And so obviously in this show, we talk a lot about hunger. He defines what hunger is. And one of my favorite things about his book and about the work that Stefan is doing is that he really takes away a lot of the shame around eating. I've always thought that what we eat is about like willpower, and people that are able to control what they eat are stronger and better. And he really puts that in a different light, and he helps reframe that so that it takes the shame and the guilt around a lot of the decisions that we make. So he does that by describing the processes and impulses that happen in our brain that drive the decisions that we make surrounding food. We talk about cravings and why we crave foods that are unhealthy for us. We talk about what stress and sleep have to do with hunger. And then finally, and maybe most importantly, we talk about how we can hack these processes to have greater control over what we eat. I got a ton out of this episode, and I hope you do too. Enjoy the show. Stefan, what's up, man? Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
So I always like to start out with something super serious, and this is called the three feelings question. And it's actually not very serious. That was a bad joke. So imagine you could have one of these three feelings. You could feel one of these three feelings constantly for the rest of your life. Which would you choose? The first is you've been working all day, doing like physical labor all day long. It's been hot out, and you are just absolutely completely exhausted. And you go into your room, you have and you get to lay on your bed and go to sleep. And it's that feeling of right when you lay down and you know that you just get to relax and go to sleep. So that's the first feeling. You could have that feeling for the rest of your life. Number two is kind of a similar thing. You've been working really hard and you've gone all day without eating. You haven't eaten breakfast or lunch, and you sit down at dinner and you get to have your favorite food of all time. And that first bite of your favorite meal of all time. So you get to have that feeling for the rest of your life. Or three, you're on a long car ride, and I don't know, maybe you're going in between a lot of cities and you're in a rush and you just can't, and you have to pee so badly, but you can't pull over, right? You have to get somewhere and you just can't pull over. And it's like that for a couple hours, and you're holding it, and it's super painful. And then you pull over and you can finally pee. And that feeling of you unzip your pants and you just get to relieve yourself. You get to have that feeling for the rest of your life. Which feeling would you choose and why?
I'm going to go with the food, because the food is, first of all, you know, eating your absolute favorite food is an intensely pleasurable experience. It is heightened by hunger, of course, and we can talk about why that happens if you want. And it's different from the peeing example, because the peeing example, that's a great thing, right? To pee when you really need to pee, but that is, you're relieving a painful state rather than creating a pleasurable state. And so that's why I would go with the food.
Ooh. I didn't think of it that way. So my thing is, because I've thought about this question many times because I've asked it to so many people. I feel like when I take that first bite, I'm still like, I'm so hungry. I'm still like pretty anxious. Like it's a good feeling, but I'm still left with like so much anxiety from being so, I don't even know if I would call it anxiety. I might just call it hunger. Like I'm still in pain because I'm so hungry. Whereas the peeing one, I feel like at that moment, like, you could just slap me across the face and I would still be so happy, you know? And I'm still like pretty alert. And the third one, the sleep one is, it's an amazing feeling, but it's kind of like sedated and maybe inhibited a little bit. And I wouldn't want to walk around all day, like kind of down and deregulated. So that's where I went with that one. All right, man. So I'm gonna start this out with a quote from your book, The Hungry Brain, and then we'll dive into everything about hunger. So the quote is, "If our eating behavior is primarily guided by conscious choices based on rational thinking, then educating the nation on what to eat should be a highly effective way of making us slimmer and healthier over time. In contrast, if our everyday eating behavior is primarily guided by brain systems that aren't so rational, information alone shouldn't be a very effective way to change it, no matter how accurate, clear, and compelling it is." So my question to you is, what is our eating behavior guided by, and how do we make food decisions?
Yeah, that's a broad question. And I'll say that, I guess to answer it in a simple way, we kind of like to think about all of our behaviors like we're in conscious control, like we're making rational decisions. But what cognitive psychologists have figured out is that actually a lot of the processing that happens in our brain is happening at a non-conscious level. And so there are tons of non-conscious things that happen in the brain, and things that along the whole spectrum of consciousness, from completely non-conscious, like the circuits that are regulating your heart rate, regulating your breathing when you're not paying attention to it, regulating the pH of your blood, regulating your digestion, tons of stuff like that that you have no awareness or control over, all the way up to our higher cognitive processes that we have complete control over, or at least almost complete control over, like where we put our attention. And so a lot of our eating behavior is guided by these really, really ancient non-conscious circuits that evolved a long time, probably a long time before consciousness even existed. And these brain circuits are highly conserved across evolutionary time. So you see them in the most primitive vertebrates like hagfish and lampreys. Lamprey is a species I talk about in the book. And those animals are like, have, you know, just pea-sized brains, and you can see a lot of the same brain circuits in their brain that you see in ours that form the core decision-making circuits of the brain. And so those animals, you know, they don't have all the brain power that we do. They, you know, can't read, they don't really have willpower in any meaningful sense, they don't have mortgages, they don't fall in love, like, but we share a ton of our brain circuitry with them. So there's a lot of stuff going on in our brain that's very, very ancient and that we don't have a lot of conscious control over or conscious awareness of. And just to give you a real life example of how that works, think about a craving. A craving is a food specific motivation. So it's not like hunger where you could eat anything. Craving is specific. You want a brownie, or you want a pickle, or you want a potato chip. And where does that come from? Like, did you decide when you woke up in the morning, hey, I want to have a craving today, and then you made yourself have that craving? No, that's something that arose from non-conscious circuits in your brain that decided based on whatever reason, and we could talk about what those reasons are, that you're going to have a craving, and it's going to generate a motivational state that's going to drive you toward that food. Similarly, hunger is a more general motivational state. So when you're hungry, it's not like, oh, I just want a brownie, or I just want potato chips, or I just want an apple. You'll eat almost any calorie-containing food, and you'll have a greater motivational level to eat food than when you're not hungry. And again, where does that come from? Did you decide you wanted to be hungry? No, nobody decides they want to be hungry. They experience hunger as something that emerges out of non-conscious brain regions that sense the body's energy status and create motivational states for eating. And so a lot of that stuff happens on a non-conscious level, again, with these very, very ancient circuits that have been keeping us alive and reproductively competent for millions of years. And so there are a lot of different reasons that we can be motivated to eat, but I think the motivation piece is really essential. And to break it down into simple terms, I would say that there's two, broadly speaking, there's two reasons why you can eat. You can eat either because of an energy need, that your body perceives an energy need, that's called homeostatic eating, or you can eat for a reason that's not related to energy, and that's called non-homeostatic eating. And so homeostatic eating, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail now, but we can come back to it. It regulates your eating drive based on your body's energy status. And so there are parts of the brain that sense your body's energy status, both your long-term energy status as determined by your body fat level and your short-term mm-hmm. energy status as determined by how the food that you have in your gut that you're eating at a meal. There may also be other things related to like liver glycogen and stuff, but we don't have a lot of evidence for that right now. And then the non-homeostatic eating is things like how good a food tastes. So if you're, you know, like imagine yourself, you've just had a big meal, you're at a restaurant and you've had a really nice meal. Let's say you're at a steakhouse. You had your steak, you had your vegetables, you had your potato, you're stuffed. And then the dessert menu comes out. You know, you don't have an energy need at that point. Chances are you already have too much food in your stomach. You already have more food than is healthy in your stomach. But when that dessert menu comes out and you see that delicious food, all the delicious foods on that menu, all of a sudden that cue, your brain knows what that means, and that cue kicks in a motivation to eat more because of the value of those particular foods to these non-conscious circuits in your brain that generate cravings and food motivation. And so that's just one example. Another example is like if you have food laying around and it's really easy, or if other people are eating food and you're doing it socially, or if you're drinking alcohol that has a lot of calories in it, but you're not doing it because you're hungry, you're doing it because you want the effects of the alcohol and you enjoy the taste. So those are all examples of non-homeostatic eating. But basically, I think one thing to really keep in mind about this as another way to consider how non-conscious all this is to think about the fact that nobody wants to overeat. So nobody wants to eat too much food. Nobody wants to put on excess fat. No one wants to have all the consequences of that excess fat, such as, you know, reduced mobility, not feeling as good, reduced physical and mental performance, reduced, you know, self-esteem, higher chronic disease risk. Nobody wants those things. And yet 2/3 of the United States is overweight or obese.
2/3.
Yeah. And in fact, the lifetime risk of obesity, not just overweight, but obesity in the United States is about 50-50. So at some point in life, about half of people will have a body mass index above 30 constituting obesity. And if you're not Arnold Schwarzenegger at the peak of his career, chances are your BMI is 30 because of fat, not enormous amounts of muscle. And so nobody wants to do it, but we do it anyway. So that suggests that there are these non-conscious circuits that are driving us to do something that our conscious circuits really don't want to do. And these circuits, they don't care about what you look like in a bathing suit. They don't care about how well you do your CrossFit workouts. All they care about is fulfilling their particular little function that mm-hmm. you're not controlling. At least you're not directly controlling, but you can influence it indirectly.
So just understanding what is good and what is bad is not enough. So I want to dive into the things that people can do to really get a handle on their nutrition and on their behavior. Before that, let's define hunger for people. What is hunger exactly?
Yeah, so hunger is a motivational state that is a motivational state of increased eating drive. And so it's not specific to a specific food, it's just any calorie containing food. You're ready to eat that, you're ready to replenish your body's energy stores. And it's also, besides being a motivational state, it's also associated with physical sensations. You might have a rumbling in your stomach. It's a negative state. It's a state that we intuitively try to avoid and try to resolve. So it's an aversive state, and it's also a motivational state, and it also has physical sensations.
Do you think that hunger is always a bad thing? And the reason that I ask this is because, and maybe my definition of it is just a little bit, needs a little bit of a reframe, but I feel like many people I know and have always known, myself included, I'm just overly sensitive to the feeling of hunger. And if I feel that just the slight, even smell hunger coming around, you know, I have to have a full meal. And I don't know, I have this intuition that I could learn to deal with a little bit of hunger, and it would be a very healthy thing for me. Well, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think it really depends on who you are. So, I mean, hunger evolved, obviously, for a very good reason. That's a really important state that we get into. It evolved to make sure our ancestors didn't run out of energy so they could survive and bear children and all that. Energy is one of the most essential components to survival and reproduction. And reproduction is the currency of natural selection. So it's pretty obvious why we have hunger and why it's beneficial in the broader evolutionary sense. But you have to figure that hunter-gatherers are always on the verge of not having enough food. So if you're a hunter-gatherer, you have to work pretty hard to get the food to fuel yourself each day. And most hunter-gatherer tribes, they weren't like starving and, you know, dying of starvation very often, but they were often not quite getting as much food as they would like, and they often were having to work harder for that food than they would like to. So, you know, hunting is a fun sport, but if you had to hunt every day to put it on your table, you'd probably get pretty tired of it, especially if it was really physically intensive every day. And so, and, you know, same with gathering berries or digging tubers or climbing up trees and getting stung by bees to get honey. It's a lot of work. And so you needed to have that sensation, that motivation to keep your energy balance sheet in the black at that time in our history. But today, it's a little different because the main problem we have today is not running out of energy, it's having too much energy in our bodies. We're eating too much food, we're storing too much of that food as fat. And so I think in today's world, I think hunger is not nearly as bad of a thing as it used to be. And I think having a little bit of hunger every now and then probably is a good thing because, you know, you're essentially doing a little bit. If you're feeling hunger, you're probably doing a little bit to counter the energy excess that is most people's everyday life. Now, that being said, you know, you and the audience that we're talking with right now is a community of athletes, and I think they have special needs that most people do not necessarily have. And so if you're someone who's training hard at a really high level, you're going to have a greater need to refuel yourself, and running out of energy is going to be a greater threat than for the average person who's not exercising at that level. So I think you need to find the balance, where the balance is for yourself. But you know, honestly, the fact that you have a very sensitive hunger switch in your particular situation, that could have been advantageous for you. I mean, to train at the level that you did, you probably had to eat a lot, right? So like somebody like me, when I'm training really hard, I can't completely trust my hunger. I don't get hungry enough to eat enough to completely refuel myself if I'm working really hard for multiple days in a row. And so I have to like force myself to eat. And so maybe that was an advantage for you because you naturally were able to maintain your energy balance and your performance. But obviously that could be a liability if you're not training at that level.
Thank you for rescuing me there. I appreciate it. Can fasting have any effects? This is kind of out in left field. I just don't want to forget to ask. Can fasting have any effects on hunger levels?
Yeah, it can increase it.
In the short term, right? All right.
Okay, there have been a few studies, randomized controlled trials, comparing fasting to regular calorie restriction. And essentially, you see really similar results. People find it similarly easy or similarly difficult, maybe a little bit more difficult with the fasting than the regular old calorie restriction. See pretty similar weight loss, pretty similar metabolic changes. So I think the average person, if you're talking about like eating, it depends on what type of fasting you're talking about. If you're talking about eating nothing for a whole day or just a little bit for a whole day, I think a lot of people are gonna have a hard time with that. The average person is gonna have a hard time with that. If you're talking about restricting your eating window, like let's say you only eat between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m., I think that's a little bit easier. The body adapts more easily because it's the same thing every day. So people find that a little bit easier. But I also think, and this is just a personal observation, not based on studies, I think the lower carbohydrate your diet is, the easier it is to skip meals or to skip entire days of eating. The higher the carbohydrate you are, the more reliant your body is on carbohydrate and the harder it's going to be to skip meals or skip days. That's at least been my personal experience.
Okay, so in a lower carb diet, you're maybe assuming that the body is more used to using fat as a fuel source, including our endogenous ketones?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is presumably the reason, but I mean, I don't know. This research hasn't been done. I'm just speculating. But, you know, when your body is adapted to fat metabolism predominantly, I mean, you're always burning some fat and some carbohydrate, but when it's adapted predominantly to fat metabolism, to switch from burning the fat that you're eating to drawing on your fat reserves, that metabolically speaking, that's nothing. There's not, gotcha. You're not having to switch over your metabolic machinery. However, if you're eating carbohydrate, your body is accustomed to primarily burning carbohydrate, and your carbohydrate stores in your body are very limited. So you have glycogen in your muscles, you have glycogen in your liver, but that stuff runs out pretty quick. I mean, you have basically a day's supply,
right,
in your muscles and liver, maybe a little bit more than that, but you'll exhaust probably more than half of it in a day. And your carbohydrate availability to your body will be dropping. And so your body has to switch over to burning predominantly fat from burning predominantly carbohydrate if you're not eating anything. And so maybe that's the explanation for why it's harder and my brain feels foggy and et cetera. But I've certainly just noticed in my own experience and from talking with other people that the higher carbohydrate my diet is, and right now my diet is quite high in carbohydrate, the more difficult it is for me to fast.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
And hunger is part of that, just to get back to the initial. So I actually feel hunger.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Let's talk about palatability. Why is it that we crave the foods that are often worse for us in terms of body composition and longevity and all those sorts of things?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really a cruel irony, but it makes total sense if you think about it from a evolutionary and a neurobiological perspective. So again, our ancestors had to struggle against the possibility of not getting enough calories. And they did that for millions and millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. And that's what every animal in the entire history of evolution on this planet has had to do, is had to fight against running out of energy. And so we've evolved these incredible adaptations to obtain energy from our environment and to use it in our bodies. And one of those adaptations is we have developed motivational systems in our brains that motivate us toward high calorie foods and allow us to learn which foods are high calorie, which foods are low calorie, and set our motivation for those foods accordingly. And so this is, so calories, the term calorie is a little bit of an abstract concept. It's what it really refers to is the potential energy contained in the chemical bonds of the foods that we eat. And so, and those can be released to do work in the body or make heat or whatever through the chemical reactions in our bodies. And so that's what a calorie is. So the point I'm trying to make here is that it's not one chemical substance. Calories are contained in different types of substances, the predominant three of which are the chemical bonds in carbohydrate, fat, and protein. And so, and also alcohol, but I won't cover that for this. And so essentially we have motivational systems that are designed to seek out carbohydrate, fat, and protein. And obviously, of course, protein has its own special things that it does in the body that aside from just energy. Mm-hmm. And so essentially the way that's played out is that we have receptors all along our digestive tract in our mouth. We can taste sugar. We can taste glutamate, which is an amino acid, a type of protein. We can taste salt, sodium chloride. That's the only reinforcing nutrient that doesn't have calories that I'm aware of. I'll get back around to what I mean by that. And then particularly in the small intestine, the upper small intestine, we have all these sensors. When you eat food, it goes down there and it detects the sugar, the starch, the fat, the protein. It detects the glutamate, which is that meaty tasting umami amino acid. It detects the salt, a bunch of other things, and it sends that up to the brain.
And how fast is that happening?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it takes a little while because it takes a little while for the food to even get into your small intestine. So I would say it probably happens over a period of hours.
Okay.
But the full truth is that we don't know how the signal gets from your small intestine to your brain yet. And so mm-hmm. we don't really know. I can't answer that question with a high degree of certainty. But I know that it takes a period of hours to reinforce behavior in animals. So presumably that process takes a period of hours. So it's a very slow process compared to other types of rewards like smoking crack or doing heroin or whatever, where the reinforcement is like instant. For this one, it takes a while. And once that signal gets up to the brain, it starts releasing dopamine. And that's the key thing that reinforces your motivational drive for that food you just ate. It causes you to experience pleasure, or it causes you to experience pleasure the next time you eat it, and it causes you to learn that the next time you see the cues associated with that food, the sight of it, the smell of it, the situation, where you are, the logo, that triggers your motivational state to want to eat that food. And so the higher the level of the carbohydrate, the fat, protein, salt, and glutamate, the higher the concentrations up to a point, of course, there can be too much, the more that's going to drive that dopamine and the more it's going to drive that reinforcement process that motivates you and causes you to have pleasure when you eat that food. And so that's why these really calorie-dense, refined foods cause those really strong motivational responses. So like ice cream and brownies and potato chips and pizza, those things are really good at spiking dopamine when we eat them because they hit those receptors really hard that were essential for survival in our hunter-gatherer ancestors' time, but today are just driving our eating behavior too hard.
So if it takes, are you saying that it takes a couple hours the first time that we eat a certain type of food, and then that afterwards the entire chain of basically what I'm getting at is like when I eat ice cream, as soon as I even see the ice cream, I like that pleasure center is activated. As soon as it hits my mouth, like my brain just lights up. And is that a direct?
Saying is correct. Yeah, you're getting at the right concept here. So let me expand on it a little bit more. So there is a learning process that happens that basically tunes your brain to have the appropriate motivational response according to the value of the item. So basically it will motivate you more and cause you to work harder for something if the brain perceives that that thing has a higher value. In other words, how much of the fat and starch and sugar and protein does it have in it? If it has a really high value according to those non-conscious circuits, it will drive you really hard. But it's a learning process. So if you've eaten pizza already in your life 100 times, the 101st time you eat pizza, your brain already knows all about pizza. That learning process is complete. And so as soon as you experience the cue of the sensory cues that your brain has associated with those nutrients, the smell and a little taste, and the triangular slices and the circular pepperonis and the box and yada yada, as soon as it recognized that cue that is associated with all those nutrients being delivered into your belly, then it triggers your motivational state. And when you start eating it, you get that pleasure reward. But this phenomenon has been known for a long time. This is the same as the classic experiment that Ivan Pavlov did in dogs. So for people who aren't familiar with that, this is a Russian researcher like 100 years ago. He noticed that when he fed his dogs in his lab, they would salivate and they would get really excited. Like anybody who's had a dog knows when you feed them food, often, especially if it's a food they really like, they get really excited. They'll start drooling. Like they have activated a motivational and digestive state that is motivating them to get that food and preparing them to digest it. Then that's the normal thing that dogs do, that humans do. But what he found is that if he rang a bell around them, nothing happened. But if he rang a bell every time he fed them consistently, they would learn to associate the sound of the bell with the food, and then he could just ring the bell and they would get excited and start drooling. And so that's how it works for us too. The smell of the pizza is the bell. The taste of the pizza is the bell. The shape of the box and the slices and the logo of the company and the situation, all that is the bell. Those are the sensory cues that didn't mean anything to you before you had eaten pizza, but your brain learns to create a motivational state when it experiences those cues as a function of having associated those with those nutrients hitting your stomach over and over and over again. And so this is why everyone in all countries of the world loves fat, loves starch, loves protein, loves salt or whatever, but not everybody loves the aromas and the textures and the presentations of every other culture. So like, you know, people in China apparently are totally revolted by stinky French cheese, and French people don't like Szechuan cooking. But both of them like fat and starch. It's just that those aromas, those sensory cues, they have not learned them. They have not acquired those tastes, especially in their childhood, by virtue of associating the taste and the aroma with the fat and sugar and salt, etc. So there you go.
That is so fascinating. It almost seems like that process of growing a stronger association with foods, it seems like learning to ride a bicycle, right? Right when we learn to ride a bike, it's not a very fine-tuned motor process, but we continue to ride, and then we can hop on with our eyes closed and ride. It's the same exact with recognizing these foods that are super high calorie.
Yeah, it's a learning process, but it's one that is so deeply ingrained in the brain and so non-conscious that we're not even aware of it. So there have been experiments done with children where they give them like weird flavors they've never tasted before, and they give them in like milkshakes that's like high fat or low fat milkshake.
Oh God.
And they do it over and over, and the children will learn to enjoy more and more the flavor that's associated with the high fat milkshake, but not the flavor that's associated with the low fat milkshake. Like, so this process happens, and the kids are like, I don't know, I just like this flavor. That's amazing. That's what we experience, but there's all this processing going on underneath the surface.
Gotcha. So in after a couple more questions, I definitely want to get into like how we can hijack these systems. First, do you think it was a mistake at all for us to, I mean, this is totally outside of anyone's control, but do you think it was a mistake for us to make food so tasty? Like, is there any, after a certain point, is there any benefit to us long term as a society or as individuals to have foods that are so tasty?
I mean, it has a benefit in the very obvious sense that it is pleasurable. So, you know, we experience a positive state when we eat it because it causes pleasure. But I would say beyond that, no, there is no benefit. I mean, there are definitely benefits to an industrialized food system. Like, we have really cheap, really safe food, at least safe in the sense that it's not going to like give us infectious
kill
diseases.
You immediately.
Yeah. So I mean,
it's more like cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, 75 years ago, the average American was spending 25% of his or her disposable income on food, and today it's 10%. So, I mean, we've seen, there have definitely been benefits to the industrialized food system, but I mean, there's also downsides, and particularly when you look at the calorie-dense, tasty food, it's, you know, those are foods that have been created by consumer demand. Like, they're just giving us what we want. We want calorie-dense, delicious, sugary, fatty, mm-hmm. salty, starchy foods. And we don't want that many of the vegetables. We don't want the healthy stuff. We don't want the fiber. We don't want to have to work for it. We want convenient, cheap, tasty food. And that's just, I mean, it's really basic stuff that's built into the human brain. Like, you know, if you're negotiating for a salary or looking for, let's say you're shopping for something on the internet, like, what are you looking for? Are you looking for the worst deal? Are you looking for the most expensive thing for the least value? No, you're looking for the thing where you get the most for the least cost. Right. And that's what our food system is set up to do. But unfortunately, that same satisfying those really basic human desires too effectively creates a situation where we're overeating. So yeah, I think there are huge problems with it, not just the fact that the food is tasty, but that it's so convenient and that we have mechanized physical activity out of our lives. Mm-hmm. So I think all of those things, they're just catering to really basic human desires, really basic.
So it was really inevitable.
Yeah, I think so.
With capitalism plus these impulses.
I agree. Yeah, I think that that's exactly right. I think if you want to trace the problems we're having with obesity and related metabolic diseases, the ultimate causes are technology and affluence, because those are the things that have allowed us to satisfy our own desires to an unprecedented extent. And our desires, unfortunately, are to not move too much and eat a lot of delicious yep. food. For most people, you know, some people, they just like love exercising. They can't get enough of it, but that's not the average person. Mm-hmm. For the average person, exercise is unpleasant. It's something they do because they have to, if they do it at all. And so that's not really a good situation for remaining fit and healthy.
What does sleep and stress have to do with hunger?
Yeah, so those are things that interact with the circuits that determine hunger and body fatness. So sleep, for example, there are some pretty, I would say, pretty well-conducted experiments showing that if you restrict people's sleep, they tend to eat more. And when you do magnetic resonance imaging, functional magnetic resonance imaging, which is a way of looking at brain activity in real time, you can see that people who haven't slept enough have higher levels of activation of the brain regions that regulate your body energy status and the brain regions that regulate your especially the ones that regulate your eating motivations and your cravings. And so basically, someone who hasn't slept enough, their brain looks like somebody who hasn't been eating enough. You have a very similar pattern of brain activity. Or a person who is overweight and has been losing weight and is really hungry all the time, similar pattern of brain activity. So it basically seems to ramp up the same pattern of brain activity that makes our food intake increase. And then stress has a couple of different effects that I'm aware of. One of them is that stress increases your levels of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and that dampens the activity of brain regions that are involved in sensing your long-term energy status. And so basically it makes your brain think you have less body fat than you do, and then it's like, oh, we better get this body fat back, and it cranks up your food intake, and it tends to cause people to pack on fat.
Very interesting.
Especially in the abdominal cavity where it's the least healthy. But another thing that stress does is, and this might seem obvious, but there's actually some pretty compelling research behind it, is it causes us to self-medicate with food. So if you have really tasty food available and you feel stressed, if you're the right type of person, which tends to be more commonly women than men, but women and men will do this sometimes, you will eat calorie dense, you will overeat calorie dense food to self-medicate. Essentially, that dampens the stress response in those stress circuits in your brain. But the good news is that you can do that in other ways as well. So it doesn't have to be eating. It's been shown, at least in rodents, that tasty food can do it, but also sex can do it. So probably any type of rewarding behavior, something that you really enjoy, something that's pleasurable, can dampen the stress response. And I think that corresponds with kind of common sense and people's experience.
Gotcha. So how can people use all of this information to make some meaningful behavior change? What are a few of the most important strategies that you teach people in your book?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is just to take the right framing. Basically, if you are eating too much food or eating food that you don't want to be eating, that you don't think is healthy, or even not exercising as much as you want to exercise, I think it's important to frame those things in terms of, it's not a moral failure necessarily. That is the result of brain circuits in your brain that evolved to make you do exactly what you're doing. And so to understand that there are specific circuits that are generating this behavior and you don't have complete direct control over those circuits, I think is a really, really good starting point. And so once you have that understanding, the question is, how do you influence those circuits? And there are different ways to do it. You know, if you have an iron will, you can just like shut it down and you can use willpower and you can say, no, I'm never going to eat when I'm hungry. I'm never going to eat when I want food, when I'm tempted. But the truth is that that's not realistic for most people. That's not something people can do day in and day out. And the vast majority of people will fail with a strategy like that eventually. And that's, again, that's not a moral failure. That's just how the human brain works. And so then the question becomes, how do we understand these circuits and work with them and give them the cues that they need to have to bring them in line with the behaviors that we, that our conscious mind wants us to engage in? How do we get those circuits to support us, or at least not interfere with us rather than undermining us at every turn? And so I think once we have a little bit of understanding of what those circuits are, then we can start to understand how to work with them. And, you know, there are a number of different strategies that I give in my book, and I won't go through all those, but I'll just give you a couple that are easier to explain. One of them is, I think it's really important to control your food environment. So, you know, just like Pavlov's dogs hearing that bell, if you have chips on your counter or soda on your counter or even ice cream in your freezer, any type of sensory cues or awareness that your brain has that foods are around that are really tempting and that you don't want to eat, that's going to generate a motivational state. And so there are different levels that you can take, but the first level is just don't have things out and visible that you don't want to be eating. Don't make those too easy for yourself either. So put them out of sight and create small effort barriers. So, you know, for example, I think, you know, it's okay to eat if you really need to eat, if you're hungry. So in my kitchen, for example, there is fresh fruit and nuts in shell. That's the only food that's visible that you can just grab and eat. So if I want to eat that, I have to work. If it's an apple, I have to peel the sticker off and wash it a little bit, and then I eat it. If it's the nuts, I have to crack them. And so there's not just like a bag of chips I can stick my hand in, or a Coke I can grab one of, or what have you, brownies or cookies or whatever. And if I want something more than that, usually there's nothing available unless I want to cook something. So that's the kind of situation I think is helpful for a lot of people. You get rid of the cues that are going to drive your motivational state, and then you create small effort barriers so that you're probably not going to eat unless you actually are legitimately hungry. So I think controlling your food environment at home and at work is really, really important.
It's enormous. One of the things, just to touch on that, one of the coolest things I heard in your, or read in your book is, I think you said something like, try to fill what's the word you used? Limit the food in your kitchen or in your fridge to things that you have to cook in order to eat. That makes it a lot less likely that your brain is just going to, or you're going to like addictively and compulsively eat snacks.
Yeah, absolutely.
I thought that was great.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you should just, the really bad offenders, like foods that you really have a problem with, like chocolate or ice cream or something, just don't even have them in your house. You know, you can have them every now and then when you go out, but don't even have them in your house. And the thing that happens when they're not in your house is not only does it become impossible to eat them on the spur of the moment, but your cravings will actually diminish. Mm-hmm. Because when those cues aren't there to trigger your brain's motivational state, you won't even experience the craving, or the craving will be less intense. So you'll actually be making it easier on yourself by planning a little bit in advance, so that you're not sitting there with looking at the ice cream trying to stop yourself from eating it. That is what's really hard. So another thing you can do is to increase the satiety that you experience per calorie in a meal. So satiety is another word for fullness, basically.
So basically increase how full you feel
per calorie
at the end of a meal. Yeah, per calorie. Okay, got it.
Yeah, and essentially you're not, the goal isn't to increase how full you feel, but the goal is to decrease the number of calories you're eating per the same level of fullness.
Right.
And so, at least for the average person who's trying to eat fewer calories, and I recognize that that's not going to apply to everyone who's listening right now, but so it turns out that there are very specific food properties that determine how full you feel. So it's not just about like your stomach doesn't have any more capacity and suddenly you feel full. Satiety is a state that is generated by the brain in response to specific signals that are coming up from the digestive tract, the stomach and the small intestine primarily. And it's responding to specific physical and chemical properties in that food. And so when you eat food that's very calorie dense, that's lower in protein, that's very high in palatability, so it's really tasty, and that is low in fiber, that does not trigger much of a satiety response per calorie. So this describes something like pizza or brownies or candy or ice cream or chips. Those are things that you eat them, they don't fill up your stomach very much for the number of calories they contain, and they don't send other signals to your brain that make you full. And so it takes you a lot more calories before you reach that state of fullness that tells you to stop putting food in your mouth. And so you won't even feel more full, but you will have eaten more calories. Conversely, if you're eating unrefined, lower calorie density foods, so calorie density refers to the number of calories per volume or weight. So things like oatmeal or fruit or fresh meats or eggs or yogurt, vegetables, those things have a lower calorie density. They often have more protein, not always. They often have higher fiber, and the palatability is more moderate. Like, yeah, a piece of fruit tastes good, a piece of meat tastes good, but it's not quite the same thing as a bowl of ice cream.
Right.
And so those are conditions that will cause you to experience the state of satiety with fewer calories. So you're not hungry at the end of the meal. You feel totally satisfied, but you ate fewer calories. And so that's another way to manipulate those brain circuits that are determining your food and motivation to allow you to eat fewer calories, to kind of bring your calorie intake in line with what you would like to be eating, but naturally, without having to actually count your calories.
A term I use a lot here is eating for volume. So eating things that take up more physical space. Is that, and you brought up the fact, or you brought up fiber several times, and are you bringing up fiber because those like foods high in fiber tend to be a little higher in volume, so it takes up more physical space in your stomach?
Yeah, that's a good question. So it's not clear whether fiber is acting via that or via something else. I don't know the answer to that. But I will just note that the main thing that determines differences in volume between foods is water. So fiber definitely plays a role, but like the difference between a bowl of oatmeal and the same number of calories of crackers, the main thing determining the difference in volume per calorie is water. Because oatmeal is like, I don't know, 80-90% water, whereas it's only like, I don't know, 10% fiber.
Gotcha. Do you think it's wise to, going back to palatability, do you think it's wise to ever make our foods less tasty, like use less salt or seasoning in our foods to, is that ever wise?
I think so. I mean, I think it is a lever that we can use to regulate our food intake without having to count calories. And so it's something that I do. You know, I don't necessarily eat like super totally bland foods, but I choose to buy unsalted nuts, for example, rather than salted nuts, because, you know, I'll eat unsalted nuts. They taste good too, but they don't quite get me like the salted nuts, you know, like, and as a result, with the unsalted nuts, especially if they're in shells, like peanuts, I'll eat them if I'm hungry. If I'm really legitimately hungry, I will eat in-shell unsalted peanuts. But if I'm not hungry, I won't eat them. If they're salted, I will eat them regardless of whether I'm hungry or not. And that's not something I want to do. So yeah, I think absolutely that matters. I will say that I don't think you necessarily have to focus specifically on that. But I think that if you're eating a diet composed of lower calorie density, unrefined foods, it's naturally going to be more moderate in palatability.
Right.
And so if you can eat, the way I try to think about it is, in my food, I'm not really going for delicious in my cooking. I'm going for satisfying. So I want to eat something that where at the end of the meal, I don't feel like I'm still needing to eat something else. However, I'm not necessarily going to be like blown away by the, you know, 3-star Michelin cooking I just did. Not what I'm going for. I'm going for just satisfaction. And so usually it'll just be simple things. Like there's a plain baked potato on my plate. There's a piece of meat. There's a salad. Or there's bean stew with potatoes in it with a couple of herbs. And then a fruit for dessert. Like that's how I eat. I'm not saying that's how everybody needs to eat, but that's a model for eating unrefined foods that are satisfying but aren't going to push your buttons so hard that you're overeating. Mm-hmm.
Now, this is super beneficial. I'm going to take two big things away from this show, and that is one of them. I think over-indexed the benefit of having tasty foods, and even if it's like something that I would deem as like completely healthy, I have a tendency to overeat. I think because of being an athlete and just continuing to eat as if I'm training 4 or 5 hours a day. And what I'm taking away is it doesn't always have to be incredibly delicious, right? It can just be satisfying. I think that's a very useful reframe, as well as the piece about being a little, you know, it's okay to be a little bit hungry, like we talked about earlier. I've got a few more questions for you, man. And kind of veering away from what we've been talking about, food that you feed your children when they're really young, how much does it matter, and does it have an effect on them later in life in terms of their preferences, their cravings, and the types of food that they'll eat as adults?
Yeah, absolutely. It has a huge effect. So, like I said, we're constantly undergoing this learning process every time we eat. As our gut detects food, it causes dopamine to spike in our brains to different levels, and that creates different levels of motivational states. So we learn to like some foods and not others. And that process is happening more than ever when we're children. So children, their brains are very malleable in that way, and so they acquire tastes easier than adults do. It still happens in adults, but it happens faster in kids. And so I think, you know, and by the way, there's no study that proves what I'm about to say. So there's no like hard evidence supporting the idea that if you teach a kid to like healthier foods, that they will enjoy those foods for life. But I certainly think it's reasonable to expect that that would happen, at least to some degree. If that child acquires a taste at a very young age for unhealthy, fattening foods, they're probably going to keep those tastes for the rest of their life. They're probably going to think of those foods as comfort foods. Whenever they feel stressed or whatever, they'll come back to those foods. Whereas if a child is eating healthy foods from the beginning, they're going to have a taste for those foods for life. And at a minimum, they won't dislike those foods, and they'll be able to eat them if that is part of their dietary strategy, as opposed to someone who is an adult and has never eaten healthy food and they suddenly have to learn. They suddenly are trying to eat healthy and they don't have a taste for it yet. You know, like they've never had kale before, or they've never had whatever, you know, some berries. It's like they may not have a taste for those foods. And so I think you're definitely putting a child at a disadvantage if they're growing up eating predominantly unhealthy foods and not learning to appreciate healthier foods. But and again, there's no studies demonstrating that, but I think it's probably true. And also, you know, I've been getting into kind of like global health and early life growth and early life health lately. That's the work I've been doing. And it matters a lot. Like the way that you develop in the uterus when you're, you know, between conception and birth, and how you develop between birth and year two has a huge impact on the rest of your life. So if you are unhealthy during that period of your life because your parents aren't eating well, because you're not eating well, that is going to set you back in terms of your body fatness, in terms of your metabolic health, in terms of your cardiovascular health. And it's going to be hard for you to catch up after that, especially if you're continuing to do those things. If you're like a 20-year-old who's been living like that for your whole life, and you already have abdominal obesity and you already have prediabetes, and all of a sudden you want to be healthy and you want to get fit, you're starting from a disadvantage. Yes, you can still get fitter and you can definitely get healthier, but you are starting from a serious disadvantage versus someone who has started off from a place of health and a place of of better body composition. So I think, yeah, the way we feed children, I think, is hugely influential.
So you're about to have your first kid. What is your plan, or how would you handle it if you're, you know, a lot of kids just, they refuse to eat some types of foods. And what I've either heard or even seen myself is parents, and I'm not saying I would have any better strategy or that I'm like better than these people, but I've seen people kind of just roll over and tend to give them highly processed, like high carb treats and all of that kind of thing, all of that kind of stuff, just kind of thinking, oh, they'll grow out of it, or they'll like this when they're older, just to kind of appease them. Like how will you, or how would you deal with that if your kids just won't eat vegetables or what you'd call healthy foods?
Yeah. So, you know, we'll see what happens. I understand that things could definitely change. Yeah. Check back in a few years. Maybe I'll have different ideas. But I have a plan. Let me put it that way. I have a tentative plan. And, you know, it's informed by the fact that I spent a lot of time in France. My dad's French, and they have a different way of doing it over there. In France, they don't just give kids whatever they want to eat. It doesn't matter if you know, don't want to eat this or that. They're not going to cook you a completely separate meal. That's just not part [S2] Right. [S1] Of the culture. And so you are expected to eat what everyone else is eating at the table, except for, you know, like very young infants when they're drinking milk or whatever. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as soon as they're weaned, they're eating the same thing parents are eating. I see people who make totally separate meals for their kids, and I'm like, how do you have time for this?
Yeah,
I'm definitely not going to do that. That said, I don't really want to get into any epic battles over food. I'm not sure how productive that is. And so basically my plan is to, you know, I make the food. I'm the cook in the house. I cook like 95% of what we eat from single ingredients. And so I make the food, I lay it out. If they don't want to eat something, I'm not going to have a big battle with it. I'll just make them taste a little bit. But I'm not going to make anything else for them. So if they don't want to eat that, they don't have to, but there's nothing else.
Amen. Amen, man.
So that's the plan. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah. I feel like they skip one meal and then they'll get hungry and then they'll eat whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like they'll eat whatever is on the table at some point, like very, very quickly.
Yeah. I'm sure that's true. And, you know, you see people all around the world, like we have more choice today about what we eat and what we feed our kids than anyone has ever had in human history. Like most people didn't have a lot of choice. In a lot of parts of Africa, if you're a kid, you're either going to eat this corn porridge or you're eating nothing. Like there just wasn't a choice. And kids, they do just fine. They eat it. You know, like you at some point, people have been raising kids without those children having the option to choose what they want to eat all over the world for thousands or millions of years. And so I think it's going to be all right.
Yeah. You're actually the boss of them. You just tell them what to do. That's the beautiful thing. And guys, anyone listening, I want to reiterate, I'm not like, I don't want you to think I'm all high and mighty and think I have it figured out when it comes to feeding kids. I acknowledge that that's a very difficult situation. And you've got a lot of things you're stressed out about. You've got work and your kids fighting with you every meal, I'm sure is a shitty situation. So, hopefully you and I will be able to feed our kids healthy food, Stefan.
Yeah, maybe we'll do the 2-year follow-up and see how the plan worked out.
There you go, man. So my last question is something that I got from a friend of mine years ago that I really love. And it's, what in your lifetime do you want to make absurd? And so just to give you a couple examples, 25 plus years ago, it was completely commonplace to go into a grocery store and see the clerk smoking a cigarette. Today, that's absolutely absurd. 10, 15 years ago, where I grew up, it was commonplace to see people throwing like entire McDonald's bags out of their window, right? Just littering everywhere. And that still happens to a degree in certain places, but for the most part, that's completely absurd. So what in your lifetime do you want to make absurd?
I would love for it to be absurd to have a city without a really good cycling infrastructure.
Ooh.
Where that would be like, nice. This city is totally weird. I don't see a single bike lane. I can't believe this.
Yeah. I like that. So first off, why is that so important to you?
You know, when I think about the problems that are facing us in terms of our fitness and our health, physical activity is definitely a huge one. And in a lot of places of the United States, it's the culture just to drive everywhere. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you're from the South. I'm also from the South. I'm from Virginia originally. And I think especially in the South, there's a really strong culture of driving and not getting around through walking and active transport like cycling and stuff. And there's just not the infrastructure. Like, people aren't used to cyclists being there. Of course, the weather is part of the reason, but people aren't used to cyclists being there. There's no infrastructure. It's dangerous. And so when people want to do it, they can't even do it. And so it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy that there's no culture of it, so there cannot be a culture of it. I think that the way that, you know, most people realistically are probably never going to get to the gym a few times a week. That's just not something that they are going to be able to motivate themselves to do. I think most people, and this is the way, you know, our ancestors had a word for physical activity, life. They got physical activity through their daily activities. And mm-hmm. I think that there are plenty of people who are willing to get physical activity as part of their daily activities, but aren't necessarily thrilled about exercising just for the sake of exercising. And so building it in, like bike commuting or going to the store on your bike, things like that, I think is a really accessible way for people to build physical activity back into their lives, get some of this physical activity back that we have mechanized progressively out of our lives. But you're not gonna have, you know, like, my mom's not gonna jump on a bike if there's no bike lane.
Sure. It's a really great, unexpected answer. So cool. I was in Madison, Wisconsin this past week, and it was one of, if not the only time I've made a mental note of, wow, this city is so well built for cyclists. And it was really, really cool. There was probably 60% of the, I don't know, real estate of the street was for cars, and the other 40% was for bikes and pedestrians and stuff. Nice. It was really cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah. All right, man. You are an unbelievable guy. This has been a great. Do you have anything you want to leave these listeners with?
I'll just say, you know, if you want to learn more about the stuff I've been talking about and get a more comprehensive and coherent accounting of it, you can read my book, The Hungry Brain. And also my website is stephanguyenne.com, or if that's too tough to spell, you can do wholehealthsource.org. And my Twitter handle, I'm pretty active on Twitter, is @WHSource. And that's going to be mostly for people who are more interested in the science side of it. I tweet a lot of studies related to obesity and metabolic disease and eating behavior.
Guys, go out and get the book. I had like 40 questions that I wanted to ask, and I had to dwindle it down to kind of 12 more general ones. So if you like what you heard, you can get much, much more in depth into everything that we talked about. Stephan, thank you so much, man.
All right. Thanks, Michael.
Have a great day.
You too.
This episode is finished, but your training journey continues. Head over to brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW and grab your free pack of 32 accessory workouts that you can incorporate into your training and start improving your strength immediately. That's brutestrengthtraining.com/SSW.